This is Pretty Much Pop, a culture podcast, always subverting the rules of podcasting. Today we're talking about the Scream films. The new one just came out, number 7, started in 1996, creation of Wes Craven and Kevin Williamson. This is Mark Lintzenmeyer, a recurring character that you thought should not keep coming back for these.
I agree with that.
This is Sarah Lynn Bruck, and I'm wondering why you need to know my name.
I don't get that reference. This is Lawrence Ware, and why did Goldface stop watching horror movies? He couldn't stand the screaming. The screaming? He couldn't
What's wrong with us today?
We couldn't stand the screaming? Okay.
What's your favorite scary movie, Lawrence?
That's
pretty good.
That was pretty good. Although the guy,
Roger Jackson.
Yeah, he's still doing that voice stuff. And he's really good at it.
Good for him.
Why, when you're going to kill somebody and they won't be able to serve as a witness against them, do you have to quickly get on the robe? Why not just kill them? It's for the audience's benefits. They don't know who did it.
It is for the audience's. Before we begin, Mark, you and I, you're not like a horror guy like I am, but we can stand it. I'm interested in Sarah. I want to know what Sarah thought about watching these Scream movies and her experience of them, because she is allergic to horror. In fact, she's so allergic to horror, I was surprised that she was able to do like the monster movies that we did back in October. Like, I was surprised she was able to stomach that. So I want to know what Sarah thought. Or should I start with like a love letter? I don't know. Mark, you're in charge here. What should we do?
Let's start positive. Let's start with the positive.
So you're negative? Oh my gosh. Okay.
Actually, I'm not negative, but I really do want to hear your ode to the Scream franchise.
Before we even do that, there was some debate in our supporter-only after talk, which most of you are not hearing.
But you should be hearing. You should be hearing.
Lawrence and I had watched all these films, but Al and Sarah had not. But they both said, all right, we're going to take one for the team. Sarah said that specifically, that this is not something she would normally enjoy. Al said, well, I'll watch the new one. I saw the first one. I'm probably not going to waste my time with the others, but, you know, it'll be fine. He has a work issue right now, so it's not that he...
Mysteriously, he has a work issue.
Well, I mean, I'll take him at his word that this was not a conscience thing. And we actually gave everybody... So, Sarah, you did see the new one then, because we had the extra...
I wasn't able to see the new one.
Oh, okay. So
you don't need to see the new one.
So we postponed...
I wasn't able to. I've been traveling
for 3 days so that Al and Sarah could see more movies. And then Sarah was traveling and Al did not see
four.
More movies.
But I've seen four of
them. That should be plenty.
That's pretty good.
Frankly.
I mean, I honestly don't know if that's plenty, but it's fine. Keep going.
And I've also, over the weekend, since we had this extra time, listened to Lawrence on the... Brucker's Autopsy of a Horror Movie. So I've already heard Lawrence's at least quick reviews of all these, which I don't agree with all of them. So that's something that we can talk about.
I low-key don't remember what I said on that podcast, but it's okay. Keep going.
All right. So, but yes, yeah, Lawrence, give us your love letter if you want to start us off that way.
I mean, I don't know if it's a love letter. Here's the thing. I think that the original Scream is a really good, innovative horror film. Is it the first? I mean... I think it's the first meta horror film that is a horror film that is commenting upon horror films, like, and going deep into the rules. And so as a young kid, I was in high school when I first saw that one, and I wasn't philosophically astute or anything, or even interested. Well, I mean, I was interested in philosophy at that point, but I hadn't done any deep reading. I did a little bit of reading of Kierkegaard. Anyway, the bottom line is that really did something to me, because it was almost a philosophical horror film in a way. It was still a legitimate horror film, but it was a horror film that was commenting on horror films and being very self-conscious about the rules of horror films and trying to articulate what those rules are and play with the rules. And that did something to me, because I had always watched horror films and I had always thought Black people are notorious for going to horror movies and talking back to the screen and all that kind of stuff. And I was one of those guys. And you're like, no, don't go there. Don't do that. Don't say that. That's not what you're supposed to do, blah, blah, blah. And so we were saying that to the film, but this was the first film that I can remember. Maybe there are other ones, but this is the first one that I can remember that was self-conscious about that. And that was intentionally playing with the tropes and intentionally playing with the rules. And I thought that was very innovative, and I really enjoyed that first one. Now, since then, I don't love it as much as I did initially because I started thinking about the motivations of people and I have issues with that. But the reason why I say I don't know if this is a love letter, because the more that I think about this, and Brucker from Autopsy of a Horror Film, good friend, he really kind of convinced me of this. It should have just been one film. I don't know if it needed to become a series because the one film is so innovative and it's so interesting and it's so good with playing with the rules that it becomes its own trope. It's like a snake eating its own tail. It becomes something. Now, I do think that number four is really good. I like that one. I love five and six as well, but seven I don't love as much. But Brucker really convinced me that maybe it should have just been one film. And I think that he might be right there, because the moment you turn into a franchise, it becomes about other things. Like, yes, number four is kind of good in that it plays with, has like multiple cold openings and all that kind of stuff. So it plays with the tropes in the same way that the first one plays with the tropes. But then it becomes about the motivations of the killers, and it becomes about the whodunits, and it becomes all about these other kinds of things. And it moves away from what made that first Scream movie so original. So that is all to say, I do like these films. I'm going to keep watching them if they kill Neve Campbell in the next one. She didn't die in part seven. If they kill Neve Campbell or get rid of her in the next one, I'll keep watching them because I think that she needs to go. But I do think that it should have been a standalone film, but that's me. Okay, you guys get into it.
I guess the fact that Neve Campbell's on the posters means it's not a spoiler that she survives most of the films, at least.
You're probably right.
But I think we should sort of avoid revealing who the killers are, because they are whodunits. They are whodunits from the start until we'll have some announcement here. So if you've not watched any of these films and you just...
I mean, everybody knows who the original killers are, don't they?
If you haven't seen the film, anyway... If you're just letting this flow because you know you're listening to the Partially Examined Life feed and this is what came up next, we'll give you some kind of warning before we start super spoiling. But I think we can reveal that it's not the same killers throughout. So this is a different kind of horror thing in that it is about the image and it's about building on itself. Right. Okay. So I likewise have a sort of ambivalent relationship with this in that I think as a young person, going meta was the mark of intelligence, was the mark of, you know, that is the examined life. You're mm-hmm. Don't just answer the question. Ask why are you asking the question?
Agreed.
Think about what the situation you're in, you know, actually take a step back. That's sort of the definition. But to what extent are they actually doing that in this film, in these films, as opposed to it is 80% just a slasher film with just a little bit of this put as sugar to make it palatable for people who think that they're too smart to enjoy slasher films. That is now my I kind of wish that it had used that self-reflective premise to the start. And as these went on, look up Society of the Spectacle. Look up Baudrillard's Simulation and Simulacra. Look up these sort of things that would enable you to more thoroughly, more interestingly self-reflect. Is this even happening? Are we in a movie?
But that would have tanked the box office. Like that, these movies would not have kept being made.
I think there are a lot of good movies like The Matrix that are using these slightly higher brow concepts to put forward this stuff. But I like the idea that this is an engagement with media, that the only reason these killings took place in the first place was because scary movies existed. In the very beginning of the first movie, it's like you get this thought that, you know, all these people, these Puritans who are arguing against this kind of movie, that would be saying, our kids going to be influenced to commit murders because of these movies? Like, and no, that doesn't happen. We don't think, you know, people blame the video games, they blame Call of Duty, all these situations. But, you know, what if that, and then what if after some murders inspired by the movies happened, a movie was made based on those murders and people were into that movie? So each of these successive movies is about the fandom for the Stab franchise.
Agreed.
An idea that's not introduced until movie two. There was juice, right? That idea alone. And I know you didn't like Scream 3, Lawrence, too much.
No, didn't like it at all.
It didn't have the original screenwriter character. Kevin Williamson wasn't working on it anymore. But I at least really liked the idea that a good chunk of it happens on the set of one of these movies that they're filming. So Sydney is back in this representation, this recreation of her old house, right? That they made the set from the first movie and that now we're going to have action. So I like the fact that each of these does successfully add a little more stuff, a little more thought, but I wouldn't overstate. They're still basically slasher movies, which they admit. Everything that you would criticize about the movie, they generally criticize in the movies, right?
They do.
Oh, how could there be more of these movies? What a big crock of...
I agree with so much of what you just said. I think the first movie, and again, I was not ambivalent about these movies. I actively avoided these movies because I don't... I knew that it going in, it was going to be a commentary on the 80s, 70s and 80s. Kind of slasher movies, which terrified me, as we all know by now. And I did not have a great relationship with them. However, I went to college and took a class where we got to dissect these 80s movies. And I thought it was really interesting that we really took a look closely at a specific subgenre within this larger horror genre of what they meant politically and about society and what they were, you know, how they were reflecting who we were in the 70s and 1980s. And what I thought was really smart about the first Scream movie is that opening sequence with Drew Barrymore, and we all think that she's going to, oh, here's a famous actress, so of course she's going to be the final girl. We all go in sort of not knowing at the time that we already have this language for understanding these movies, how to watch these movies. And so when she ends up, and I don't think this is a big spoiler, when she ends up dying in that opening scene, we're all kind of off balance.
It's just like Psycho, right? Where Vivien Leigh, you know, was the big star.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Except that happens, I think, halfway through the film. This is right from the beginning.
Right from the beginning. Yeah.
And so I think that for me, watching this now, and now I'm a bona fide adult, and so I've been able to watch a little bit more horror lately without losing my mind. But I really thought that first movie was so smart. And then so kind of knowing that, the way that I approached the subsequent movies, and I only got through four, and I'm actually really glad I did, was seeing how that metaverse kind of evolved as it went, because I think it did try to, it wasn't trying to do the same thing over and over again. And I think, Lawrence, you're right. By four, they were really commenting on something that was very current at the time. It was really, really modern at the time. And I don't know if it's continued to do that, if it's continued to be that smart. I don't know that I need to watch any more of these, but I think that this particular horror series is very smart. It knows its audience so well. And there's a reason why it's as popular as it is.
Yeah. And the interesting thing about this, at least with me, is that the film that I like the least is the most successful financially. Then that's Scream 7. Because Scream 7, it's mean. I didn't love it. I mean, it's fun, but I didn't love it. I didn't think it was a very good representation of the Scream franchise, but that's going to probably make $200 million. And that's going to by far make the most. Now, people try to argue, well, you know, adjusted for inflation, blah, blah, blah. I mean, but just on its face, it's going to be the most financially successful of the Scream films. But I do think that what is interesting and innovative about the Scream franchise is that it is self-consciously. Now, I hardcore disagree with Mark that it should have gone really, really postmodern in its philosophical approach, because you risk alienating the audience when you do that. And I think that the first Matrix film was really successful. The subsequent Matrix films were less successful. And I think because those films got a little bit more head up their ass in the first one, because the first one remembered, this is an action film. And yeah, we can play with these ideas, but this is an action film. The thing is that these are horror movies. They are slasher movies. You know, there are going to be jump scares. There are going to be killers. And yeah, you can play around with the form a little bit, but you got to make sure that you bring the audience what you promised them. My issue with the first film, those of you who want to go over and listen to that podcast, Autopsy of a Horror Film, we have a lot of fun over there. I've become kind of like a semi co-host. I don't know. He has me on a lot. Anyway, the thing about the first one that I kind of don't love is because of the reveals and the motivation of the killers, which I'm not going to go into here. But the idea, though, that like the meta idea, the idea of taking horror films seriously, like not saying that they're silly films and these people who make these films are silly people and that they're dumb, but like taking them seriously, legitimately seriously as its own art form, because they are, you know, when you look at the gore effects in Friday the 13th Part 1, that's some artistry going on there with Tom Savini. It just is. Yeah, it's a silly movie. Yeah, it's kills, but there's some artistry. People put their hearts and souls into these films. They really think about how to make these films good and successful in very much the same way that In a Violent Nature, which is a film I would not recommend Sarah to watch, but In a Violent Nature kind of plays with the idea of Jason, and instead of taking the camp counselor's perspective, but you follow the perspective of the killer the entire time, which means you spend 15, 20 minutes just walking through the woods, and that's it. Just walking through the woods. But it's playing with the format. It's trying to do something innovative and different. People are really serious about these films. They try to do things very innovative. And Wes Craven is a legendary director. I mean, we're talking about the guy who did Nightmare on Elm Street and Last House on the Left, like the original ones from the 70s. Like, he is a legendary horror director. And so it makes sense that he would be the one to do that first Scream film and play with the format and think about the format, because he's so steeped in it. And I think that the original film and all the films really do something very interesting and very innovative. And I'm very happy that I got them. Now, I do have my quibbles with some of the films. I don't love one as much as everyone else loves one, but I'm very happy that I got it. And I think that it shows that, you know, the snobs who are like, oh, you know, horror films are stupid, blah, blah, blah. No, but there's something here, and there's something to take seriously. There's something to think about. There's something to examine. And there's a reason why these films have persisted for so long. And this film is kind of both adding to the genre, but also reflecting on the genre.
I guess I do want to spoil the first movie so we can get into that.
Okay.
Spoiler alert.
Yes. So just revealing, I remember that it was two killers. Mm-hmm. Like, that was a big thing at the time. Like, wait a second.
That was huge.
You can do that?
Yeah.
This provides the foundation for the subsequent movies. Like, oh, this new character is the original killer's illegitimate child. Oh, this other killer is the other relatives.
It's a little bit more complicated. I mean, so part two, the mom is involved. I mean, it's a little bit more complicated than that. But yeah, I mean, oftentimes in the subsequent films, the killers end up having some kind of relationship, tangential relationship to either the killers. In part five, we're introduced to the Monica Barrera character, and she turns out to be the daughter of Billy Loomis. And so there's an interesting relationship there. I mean, they tend to have some kind of relationship to the original killers, and then it gets complicated from there. I mean, the killers' motivations are oftentimes a little weird to me, and I don't love the whodunit kind of aspect of it sometimes. Sometimes I like it, sometimes I don't.
This episode is brought to you by Squarespace. Although arguing about movies is my true passion, for my day job I run a small tech business. When I started out, I knew that I could build a website any number of ways. I could have scratched something together by hand if I'd wanted, or stitched something together using a bunch of different tools. I love a project, but I had actual work to do, clients to find, invoices to chase, and products to ship. So I used Squarespace, and it got out of my way. I expected it to be easy. I've heard ads like this before too. What I didn't expect was how flexible it was and how many of the things I'd been worrying about, managing payments, data compliance, domain management and security, Squarespace could comfortably handle even for a niche tech startup like mine. For a small business that needed to look credible and operate cleanly from day one, that really mattered. It is genuinely all in one, domain, design, payments, the compliance scaffolding underneath. You're not bolting six different tools together hoping they talk to each other. It just works. Which means your attention stays where it needs to be. If you want to just get a website done, go to squarespace.com/pretty for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use code PRETTY to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
Often it's about fame. It's about society's reflection on itself. Based on your recommendation, I also, in the last week, watched that film, One Hell of a Summer.
Oh, really? You actually watched that?
Co-written and directed by...
Finn Wolfhard, I think it was?
Finn Wolfhard, one of the Stranger Things fellows, which likewise has a... I don't care about spoiling that movie. It's not actually that great.
It's not that great.
It's just the killers are in a summer camp, are just a couple of the kids that are like, if we do this, we'll get really famous. You know, we'll be the killers, or maybe we'll be the survivors. We'll frame somebody else. You know, just so these, I don't know if that's a goofy motivation, because like some people that do school shootings, that sort of is.
Some people do like, that exactly. And that's the thing. Yeah.
I want to shoot a celebrity. I want to shoot the president because that's the only way for a nobody like me to gain notoriety, to actually matter in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't seem like a thing in the first Scream. It seemed like that was a thing by the...
In the latter films.
Yeah, in the latter films. Or by,
I agree.
Even by four.
Yes.
It seems like that was a theme. But what I found interesting in the first Scream, since we're already spoiling who the killers and stuff were, connected to Sydney, the main character's mother, who was having an affair and was punished for having an affair, which was... a trope from the 1970s and 80s slasher movies. So it was, again, smartly making that connection between what they were commenting on and bringing it to the then present, which was mid-90s. But I thought that was actually really interesting. So that, yes, the mother had already been punished, you know, off screen a year before, and then her daughter is now punished. And then her daughter, again, loses her virginity, of course, to one of the killers themselves. So again, it's just playing with layer after layer after layer, which I thought was really smart.
It was. And the thing is that Mark is commenting on, the original film happens in the mid-90s, early... I think it's mid-90s. 96. Okay, so latter... mid-90s. What's happening... along these films being made is the internet blowing up, the rise of true crime podcasts, right? And so the films smartly incorporate those things into the films, right? And even in part five, there's like this whole gimmick about the fact that we now have houses that can self-lock and they're connected to Ring or whatever, and it plays with that. You know, so the films are, as technology is progressing, they're trying to incorporate technology into it. Mm-hmm. And then that also plays into the motivation of the killers, because the killers are now trying to, because once upon a time in 1996, I think the most notoriety you'd got was like a Diane Sawyer interview or something like that. I don't know.
Or tabloid journalism.
Yeah.
And that was definitely a huge part of the movie.
It was. But then the latter films, there's more ways to get famous. And so they're incorporating those different ways to get famous into the motivation of the killers. That is simultaneously a commentary on horror films and a commentary on us as human beings in the world. When Scream films do that, that's when they're at their best to me. Because, again, I've seen so many slashers. I don't need a new slasher. I mean, I'll watch them, but I don't need one. What I want is a film that is simultaneously commenting on the films that it is a part of. Like, so it's commenting on the genre, but also it's commenting on us as viewers of this and asking, why do we like these kinds of films? Why do we like these killers? Why do these killers fascinate us? And how does our relationship with the killers motivate the killers to do even more things? Like, that's an interesting kind of relationship that the films are playing with. And I really enjoyed that. That is why I come for the films, because I want that kind of commentary. And the seventh film fails in that regard massively, but it was still financially successful. So great. We're getting at part eight, almost certainly.
I really like the casting in these in general. That,
really?
That it's like any good whodunit. Like, don't just have one minor character be a celebrity, because then you know like that is who did
That's
it.
The one. That's the one who did it. Yeah.
We're going to just have... And I don't know how famous, you know, so Scream 2, just like all the kids in the class are like you've seen from other things.
Isn't that the one with Sarah Michelle Gellar? I think part two has Sarah Michelle Gellar, and she like dies like in the first 20 minutes, I think.
No, Jada Pinkett.
Jada Pinkett is in that one as well. And so I was expecting those people, because I was like, oh, they're famous. They're going to make it all the way through. Omar Epps was in there. I was like, oh, he's famous. He's going to make it all the way through. And they always kind of played with that. At least originally they did. They played with that idea of casting these very, very famous people who you think are going to be there to the end, and they get dispatched relatively quickly.
casting Liev Schreiber in the first one, and he's in it for like 2 minutes.
Yes, I know.
Because he's like the that it's a red herring. I don't remember how famous he was at the time. Like, did they just pick somebody?
I'm betting he probably wasn't, but the fact that they brought him back for the second one, I think, is pretty genius.
I think he was a little famous.
Let me take a look at what his first film was.
I see Omar Epps was in number two. I don't remember him in that. Oh, well,
he's in the beginning. He's in the beginning. Yes, yeah. Okay. Yeah, he's in the beginning. Him and Jada Pinkett were in the beginning. But he's such a big star at that time because he was in major films at that time.
Sure.
Because I remember a lot of black folks like, oh, Omar Epps is in this one. Jada Pinkett is in this one. Let's go watch that. And we were like, yo, they get killed first. But they comment on the fact that black people get killed first. It's very smart what they do there.
Mm-hmm. Josh Jackson, who was in Dawson Creek at the time, as film class guy number one. Like, we're just gonna, is it just that they make these things on a Hollywood lot and just like, who can we get to do the day?
And Portia de Rossi was in there. I was so surprised to see her.
Was she famous yet? I don't know. This was not.
That was before Ally McBeal. That was the first time I was introduced to her.
I don't know who that is. Yeah.
Well, she's married to Ellen DeGeneres.
Ellen. Right? She is now. Yeah.
Interesting. I mean, but maybe it's a mixture of just really good casting and knowing good young actors to cast, or maybe they are subverting our expectations, because I do know with Sarah Michelle Gellar, Jada Pinkett, with Omar Epps, they're subverting our expectations, but it could be that with someone like Portia, they're just really good at casting young actors. And maybe same thing with Joshua. Like, they were just really good. Although Joshua was pretty, he was a big deal at that point, wasn't he?
Probably.
But it could be Kevin Williamson is the writer. Or was he the creator of Dawson's Creek? I think it was the creator of Dawson's Creek.
So by Scream 2, we have the extra meta layer of Stab. And all of the stars who are in this fake movie, Stab, like Heather Graham is in Stab. Yeah. Luke Wilson makes an appearance. You know,
those are legitimately big stars at that point. Yeah,
I'm like, oh my God, they got so much right. And actually, Mark, you were saying when you're trying to talk me off the ledge when you said we were doing Scream next, you said that your wife is also not a fan of scary movies, but she finds these movies really fun. And I totally get that. I totally get why this is fun. There's so much humor in these movies. And it's actually not that gory. Are these not like PG-13 movies?
Well, the newest one is gory. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
But there is such an element of fun to these movies that makes them pretty great.
So my update as far as that goes is she originally was like, okay, I'll see the new one with you. I don't need to rewatch any of these. But then she changed her mind and did rewatch the first one with me. And she thought that the scene, especially at the end, where the two killers have been revealed and they're trying to like give wounds to each other. And Matthew Lillard is so over the top, like, oh, you stabbed me too hard. She's cracking up. Just thought that was hilarious.
It was hilarious. Like, Matthew Lillard is he's a gem. He's a really good, like, he's good at what he does. He really he is. Does.
Yeah, he's very funny.
Didn't he just change his name to have Shaggy in his actual name?
I don't know. But I would believe it even if it wasn't true. He is such a weird guy, but he's fun.
As far as the technology thing, thanks to deep fakes and things, that's the thing in the new movie, is we can have not just calls, but video calls. And we can show multiple characters who are dead from previous movies. And so Matthew Lillard gets to be in this movie
as a deep fake. Yeah.
Good for him.
He's really fun in the movie too. Like, the performance he gives is really over the top and fun in in part seven. It's really good.
So he's only seen through these calls, and they're pretty sure it's a deep fake, but maybe actually that somehow that character, one of the killers from the first movie, did survive this whole time with amnesia. And they reflect on, like, that would be so stupid to bring back a character that way. And of course the movie's not bringing back the character that way. Like, that is, it's not a spoiler about like what happens, because you don't think that's actually going to happen, but a spoiler about like how dumb are these are these movie makers, or how desperate or something. I was actually confused because one of the other characters, I saw that he was on the cast list for this, and I'm like, didn't he die in a previous one? But it kind of hit home that as far as the victims go, you know, somebody could have a graphic, gross death scene and be stabbed like 17 times. Oh, and they survive and they get to be in the next movie. How many times has Courtney Cox
you know. No, Dewey. Dewey's the one. Dewey's the one who's gotten...
That was who I was talking about.
Yeah, Dewey's the one who's gotten, like... I remember at the in part two, like, he has, like, a hand thing, which is, like, a commentary on the fact that he barely survived part one, and he got rid of it in the subsequent films. But, like, Dewey's been through it, and he eventually does... I guess it's a little bit of a spoiler for you, Sarah. Like, he eventually does die in the films. But, like, Dewey's been through it, man.
These new twin characters in the last three movies.
Yeah, the twins, they've been through it as well. Although they're really good. They're really good.
Every single one of them, they basically die, and yet they're
They have. Well, I mean, it's because they're so good, though. Like, they're so smart. They're so funny. In fact, they're the best part, I think, of part seven. Like, their banter is the best part.
Has there been any discourse on Gail Weathers' hairdos?
I'm sure there has been. I haven't paid attention to it.
The hair that they have given her, I'm like, why are they doing this to my Courtney Cox? Like, what are they doing here? Her hair is hilarious in these movies. I feel like that is just another undercurrent of, again, tabloid journalism, tacky, you know, like, what are they doing? They give her really bad highlights once. They give her, like, way too short bangs in the third one. It's like, what are you doing to this girl?
I did watch part two yesterday, and I didn't notice those highlights. Those highlights were aggressive in part two. Oh, my God. They were aggressive in part two. And maybe it is because when I think about the journalists who are, like, on hard copy. Is that even a thing? Is hard copy even around anymore? On those kinds of television shows, their hairstyles are oftentimes like that. And so maybe, because Courtney Cox knows how to get her hair done in a decent way. Like, you know, you see her in the world, she knows how to look proper. I think that's probably a commentary. Now, again, I'm not aware of that. I'm not in a lot of discords about women's hair, but
we have not had that episode yet. Sarah, if you want to lead us,
just be careful you talk about black women, because it gets tough there. But yeah, I guarantee you that there's probably a thought in the minds of the filmmakers and in the costume designers and in makeup and hairstyling to make her look that way, because her hairstyles are oftentimes aggressively tabloidy.
Yes. And even when Parker Posey was her character in Stab, they did the same thing with her hair. I was like, there were multiple conversations I know about Gail Weathers' hair.
And see, this is why we need you here, Sarah, because me and Mark
this
would not have noticed
that. For today, yes.
But that's important. That's important. That's important context.
Little detail.
Yes. So in number three, Emily Mortimer playing a unrecognizable Patrick Warburton in a very minor part. Lance Henriksen.
Yeah.
Jenny
McCarthy.
Matt Keeslar, I didn't know who that was, but he's another guy from Waiting for Guffman. I had just coincidentally watched that again, that Parker Posey is in with it, which was about the same time that this movie came out.
Yeah. So
the fact that you have a good percentage of the Waiting for Guffman cast in there, I thought was hilarious.
And Patrick Dempsey, like, between when he was doing those stupid teen comedies in the 80s and before he became McDreamy, he was right there. He was almost McDreamy, but not quite. He was still a little too skinny.
Were those films in the 80s stupid? I liked those films in the 80s.
I liked them too. No, stupid is definitely not necessarily
teen comedies. The one of the guys or whatever. I don't remember which.
He did the one where he played the kid who mowed the girl that he has a crush on, her lawn. He was their lawn mower.
Can't Buy Me Love.
Can't Buy Me Love. Thank you. Yeah.
I used to love those movies. They're not stupid. They're perfect for me. But yeah, I mean, I think that the casting is oftentimes very smart. I mean, to cast Jenna Ortega, you know, at the beginning of really her ascendancy into popularity before she's big and Wednesday and all that kind of stuff, to cast her is really smart. They damn near kill her at the beginning of that film.
Right. That's the subversion.
Yeah.
Is that you think the character has to be killed in the first scene, but not quite. That she gets to be.
Because she survives. Yeah. They like playing with the tropes that they create. And the latter films begin to comment on Scream itself. And I don't know how much I like that. I don't know how much I think that works, because part six is almost exclusively a commentary on the Scream / Stab franchise. And again, I don't know how much I think that works, but I do think that they keep trying. They keep trying to do things that are smart. They keep trying to do things that are innovative. And sometimes you're going to miss, and sometimes you'll hit. But they keep trying, and I think that's very admirable. Now, again, I maintain that I think it should have just been one film, but if they're going to keep doing them, at least try to be smart about them, which they have tried to do.
Yeah, so Lawrence, you had defended in the other podcast appearance that you thought these 4, 5, and 6, but the last three, right, where new filmmakers came in, that actually having a new generation, so this is always the big risk, like, is it going to be like Star Wars, where it's it's just not the same,
or it goes off, yeah, it goes off the wheels.
Four still seems connected to the first three.
Yes, that was the revival of the original creators.
That's still Wes Craven.
And Kevin Williamson coming back, yeah.
He did come back for that. Yep. That's right. But for me, for my taste, and then after that, I forgot the name of the directors.
So it's Matt Bettelini-Open and Tyler Gillett. I don't know if that's a correct.
They have a name that they go by together as a, I forgot what the name is, but they're responsible for the Ready or Not,
part Radio one, Silence?
Ready or Not. That's it, Radio Silence.
Yes, so I just coincidentally watched Ready or Not this week as well, because the, you know, the new movie is being pushed, and that's the movie they did right before they sort of took the helm of the Scream franchise temporarily. This is something we should talk about, because they and Jenna Ortega and, you said the other actress's name,
Melissa Barrera,
yes, I think her name is. You know, we're in these, these two films as sort of the major characters, much like in Star Wars, where we're going to have, and they met, you know, they talk about this, of course, they're meta about it, like, we're going to have some legacy characters. Right. In fact, Neve Campbell was supposed to be in the one that she was in, but it was a pay dispute. They didn't want to pay her enough.
Yeah,
they didn't want to pay her. The idea of like, oh, we heard something's going on in the world involving the Ghostface Killers. I'm on the case. Let me show all the old characters have to come back, no matter how many times this happens.
If I had survived a terrible attack and I saw that a guy was doing something similar, I would go to that town and try to help. But keep going about Melissa Barrera, though.
Well, all right. Lawrence is a is a better man than I.
I'm defending it. I'm defending what they're doing. I'm defending what they're doing.
Yeah, just the idea that I think it was, yes, the first thing was Melissa Barrera posting too vehemently anti-Israel stuff. So she got dropped.
It wasn't that vehement. She just posted something in defense of Palestine. That's all she did. And she said that the legitimate horrific things that were happening to the Palestinian people was not okay. And that got enough to get her canceled. And so when she got canceled by the screenwriters and the filmmakers, then Jenna Ortega, she said she had scheduling difficulties with Wednesday, came out later on that she was leaving in solidarity with her. And then Radio Silence said, well, then we're leaving as well. And so that's ultimately the fallout from what happened there. But, you know, the film ended up being successful. There's all this talk about there being boycotts. The boycotts didn't do anything. But that was the reason for the big break. It was significant. Like, it could have torpedoed the Scream franchise. It really could have.
I thought Jenna Ortega said that it was because the directors left was one of the reasons, that it was not just...
Yeah, it was both. Yeah, it was both.
This is what the news articles have been in the lead up to this.
Yeah.
And it sort of doesn't matter. But, you know, narratively, like when you've set up that these are your new protagonists, and now in the new movie, you just say, you know what?
All of a sudden, they're gone. You got to go back
them.
To...
We're just not even going to mention them. We're not going to give any... It shouldn't matter. but for some reason, it does. Whenever things like this are recast, like what would have been crazy is to just have those characters there with different actresses.
that would have been terrible. Oh my gosh.
Oh my goodness.
Oh my gosh. I don't think that's a good idea. That would have been terrible.
Make Christina Ricci, just because she played Wednesday too. Playing the Jenna Ortega character, but she's
that would have been
that is very meta.
That would have been terrible. But honestly, Melissa Barrera, she's a little bit of a big star. Jenna Ortega is the huge star. Like, she's the one. And her exit from the film franchise, that is big. And they needed to do something to try to mitigate that loss. Because the Radio Silence directors, I mean, they're good, but you can replace those guys. Melissa Barrera, she's good, but you can replace her. It's Jenna Ortega. Like, that's the one. And her leaving was a significant departure from the film, so much so that it could have torpedoed the franchise. But clearly, it didn't, because this seventh film is the most financially successful one, even though it's clear that the film was rewritten and a lot of stuff was going on behind the scenes, because it's just really not that good.
So is the setting of the movies, is it always in Woodsboro? Is it always in Sonoma County?
No, it changes because part one is in Woodsboro. Part two is at a college campus, if I remember correctly. Part three is that in Hollywood, Mark? Yes. Part three?
Yeah.
That's in Hollywood?
Oh, right, because it was
the
on...
the shooting of the studio. Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
then part four, they go back, I think.
They go
I
back
think
they go to back Woodsboro.
Woodsboro. Okay. And then part six, they're in New York City. Part seven, they're in a whole different...
So five, I town. Don't remember. I thought it was a different...
I don't remember five either. I don't remember with five either.
Right, okay. Yeah. So the new one, right. They return to Woodsboro. The opening scene is one of the houses.
Yeah, they burned down Stewie's house.
Yeah, so like that has been made up as a stab museum.
Well, it's an Airbnb, I think. Well, it's a museum Airbnb. Yes, yes. Yeah, it has a theme. Has a theme or something like that.
Right. Which one?
So,
which one?
This is the new one.
Seven? The new one.
Part seven.
Yeah, so I thought that was a clever sort of, again.
It was. It was really
like
smart.
Although, you know, the way it was executed.
But the idea was smart. The execution is a whole different thing. I mean, because Kevin Williamson directed this. He's not a great director. So the execution was kind of out there. But the idea was really smart.
Right. So, well, even in just the way it was written. So as soon as you see that there is an animatronic ghost face killer that is set up in this house, you know that
you know
this
coming.
Is going to be, if there's only a dummy in any situation, the
you know
is
it's
going
coming.
To be that dummy or something. Like that.
Absolutely.
Just, that is
yeah.
a trope.
yeah.
But maybe this is, you know, intentional. This is, to what extent are these actually trying to fool you? Al's one contribution that he sent us through WhatsApp as we are getting ready this morning is, why are these dumb movies smarter than me? Because they still manage to, in many cases, you know, you can't figure out who done it necessarily in a way that most other films, or I don't know, just all these, like, I watch not a lot, but enough procedural TV where the cops are going to figure out the murderer. And you can kind of figure out, like, okay, they've interviewed five people. You can probably guess most of the time. At least you could feel like maybe the audience is supposed to feel like they can be 10 seconds ahead of the characters. Like, so we've kept the secret for this long, but now we've done something so that you can feel like you're so smart, but yet the characters will get there and it won't be like 20 minutes of dramatic irony where the audience knows who the killer is, but the characters don't. So I feel like they at least do that well in these movies. That you generally, even if you had suspicions of somebody, they put, again, enough famous supporting actors that you're not really sure.
Except with part seven. Part seven, the casting kind of gave it away. But typically, they're really smart about where they're placing people. And, you know, best actress winner ended up being the killer in part five. You know, so Mikey Madsen, best actress winner, you know, last year. Like, their casting is so good in these films. And she's really good in that role.
All right, what else do we have to say about that? I mean, we often ask, do we want more of these? We're clearly going to get more of these. You know what we haven't talked about, really, the recurring characters, because...
Yeah, we haven't.
I don't like the fact that David Arquette kept coming back and Courtney Cox kept coming back, but I don't really want Courtney Cox without David Arquette. Like,
I agree. Yeah.
David Arquette is the appealing center of these films.
Watching these films, I got a whole new appreciation for David Arquette. Like, he's pretty good and funny and silly, and he brings a levity. And, like, he does this whole, you know, bumbling cop thing, but he does it so well. Like, I got a whole new appreciation for him. Now, they were married. Are they still? They're not still married,
no.
Are they? David Arquette and Courtney Cox?
No,
they broke
they're
up.
They're long divorced.
Did you go to the divorce party, Sarah? How do you know that?
No, I wasn't
Keep
invited.
Keep up with the goss. Yeah, I want to see Jamie Kennedy in more things, too. Maybe he's not as appealing as he was when he was a teen, but...
Yeah, you know what? Actually, I had that same thought, because I didn't really appreciate him when he was out in the 90s, but he was really, really funny. I wondered if he's still doing stuff.
I haven't seen him in decades. I don't know if that guy's still around, honestly.
Apparently, he was in Bowfinger. I don't remember him in Bowfinger. Well, that was still the 90s.
That was still nice. I don't remember. I don't remember him in that film.
I'm just looking at the wiki. He was in Roe v. Wade, 2020. Had lead roles.
Okay, well,
he's still having lead roles in Trick, a 2019 slasher film. Did you see that, Lawrence?
I did not.
With Omar Epps as well.
Really?
Omar Epps and Jamie Kennedy reunited.
Had no idea. I'm gonna hunt that down.
So Neve Campbell has been in Lincoln Lawyer recently. I find her so pretty. And I feel gross saying that, you know, when she's 17, but then it's okay by Scream 4 to like be into her. But is she a good actor?
But she's like our age.
Right.
Like,
that's what I'm saying. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is she actually a good actor?
That's okay.
Or is she just basically a model?
She never had a great career. Like, her most notoriety was from the Scream films. I don't know what else she's done that has
Party
really broken through
that
like
Party
that.
Of five,
oh,
yeah.
Oh, I didn't watch that. That was a white TV show in the 90s. I didn't watch that one, though. Melrose Place, Party of Five, 90210, I didn't watch none of that shit. She doesn't come across to me, particularly in the most recent film. I don't get the impression she's a great actress. I mean, you guys can weigh in on that. I'm not very impressed with her acting. She does a serviceable job for these films, but I'm not, like, blown away by her acting at all. Like, do you guys think she's a good actor?
I mean, I think she's okay. In Lincoln Lawyer, she's not like wooden or anything. She's like a perfectly fine actor.
Well, I haven't watched that show.
She is called upon in these films to do some like crying and like not just when being attacked, but like I'm having PTSD. I sort of don't know how to judge it in some ways.
I think it's hard to really judge if someone's a good actor or not based on the work that we're presented with, because mm-hmm. I don't know what her range is. I mean, I think that she has done a perfectly serviceable job in the roles that she's been given. I thought she's been great. She's performed that role believably, but I don't know that in anything that I've seen her, that she's really kind of stretching any sort of, I don't know, acting capabilities. I don't know. I haven't seen her in enough things to really know if she could really stretch in that way. But I think in the roles that she's been given, I think she's done a great job.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I've seen her in The Craft, and I wasn't very impressed with that. I saw her in Wild Things. You guys remember that movie from 1998?
I didn't see that.
Yeah, that was the same stream of success.
And then in 2004, she did this really interesting movie. It's almost an art house movie called When Will I Be Loved? I remember that film and I watched it and wasn't very impressed. I mean, so I haven't been impressed with her.
She was in House of Cards.
Yeah, she was. She's had chances to show her range and I just never got the impression that she had it, if I'm being honest with you.
I think it's a similar thing with Kristen Stewart, that, you know, they're the center of these franchises, but they seem in some ways to suck the air out of the room.
Kristen Stewart lately has been doing some good work.
Yeah, Kristen Stewart has really stretched herself. Yeah, she's really stretched herself recently.
Yes,
yeah.
That right. Kristen Stewart's solution to that was to play against type,
yeah,
to completely change her hair, to be unrecognizable. And Neve Campbell could have done that, but I guess she just, you know, had enough money and had a family and like was a normal person. was my suspicion of like why she has not been in so many things over these years.
I mean, I think she has a family. I think she probably lives a pretty balanced life is my guess.
And she got more than enough money. So
good.
Just keep doing what works.
And then I guess the Courtney Cox character, is she allowed to have growth? Not really, because it still has to be, she has to be the little bit from the, you know, purely cutthroat, I'll do anything for the story, I'm a slimy person, I will lie to people, to, oh, now she is a love interest, but are they're on again, off again? And she still has to keep showing up and still has to be resented by some of the other people there for continuing to write books and make money off this. Any takes on that character choice here?
Courtney Cox was an all-time smoke show in the 90s. Well, I guess Jennifer Aniston was a breakout star of Friends, but she was right there. Like, she really had a really good career off that. And I don't even know if you guys remember this film, but she was in Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, and she was an all-time smoke show in that movie. But is she a good actress? I mean, because Neve Campbell is definitely a better actress than Courtney Cox, I would argue. But Courtney Cox is... Or is she just a pretty face? I never really knew what to do with Courtney Cox.
She's been working forever. When she started Friends, she was an absolute known quantity. She had been on Family Ties for a long time. She had been working. She, of course, was in that Bruce Springsteen video.
That's right. I forgot about that. That's right.
She had been working a lot and she was known before Friends even started. And I think there's something to be said to that she has been working since... the early 80s all the way through now. She has been working steadily since then. And I think that that means, one, that she's probably pretty easy to work with. I think she's a total pro. She's a professional. She probably shows up on time. She's probably not an asshole on set. I'm guessing she's probably a nice person to work with. And I also think, too, she's probably talented. I think you have to be talented in order to be working that long.
That's fair. That's fair.
That steadily. And I also think she's somebody who knows her brand. I hate that word so much when it's applied to people, but I think she knows exactly what it is that she does. And I think she does it really, really well. And I think that can be applied to the Gale Weathers character. She knows exactly what to do with that character. She's hilarious as that character, but she also, I think, brings a humanity to that character. Otherwise, we wouldn't believe that there's going to be a relationship between her and Sydney, you know? I don't think that could ever work if she was just kind of a cartoon, or if she was only a two-dimensional kind of cardboard character.
What that makes me wonder is maybe she hasn't gotten the right role. Maybe she hasn't stretched herself. Because if she is talented, which I suspect to be true, if she's been working this long, she should have broken through and gotten that Oscar nomination something. I'm sure she probably got nominated for an Emmy for Friends.
She's probably just good in comedies. Like, I don't know that she's is going to play those kind of things.
Maybe she doesn't. She may not want to. You know, Jennifer Aniston does that sometimes. That may not be something that she wants to do.
It's possible.
Well, we should just assign ourselves to watch a little bit of Shining Vale, which I see is a Sharon Horgan made TV show. I liked her stuff generally, that Courtney Cox is the star of, that is on Max now, but it was on the Stars Network first. So that's why we didn't hear about it.
is it still making? Is it still happening?
Okay. It was two seasons. And then it was canceled, 2022 and 2023.
Oh, wow.
And just got on HBO Max last year.
Judith Light is in that? Oh.
Yes, Greg Kinnear, Mira Sorvino.
Wow.
Sherilyn Fenn from Twin Peaks.
Sherilyn Fenn, wow. Yeah, so that's good.
A satirical comedy horror TV series that usually should be something that I would like. And I thought we talked about doing horror comedies. As I feel like I'm getting into after talk stuff here. Let's finish off here before
before we
after talk here. All right, we're going to get more of these, but because the shift to the new cast, the next generation failed, those people left the show. So I think it's going to be a challenge to find something else. Let me say one more thing about the new movie. Yeah, why was it so much more gross? Why did it have these scenes? And in fact, I don't mind spoiling something that, you know, they've had, I think, multiple things where you think this person couldn't be the killer because, like, their child was one of the victims. And in this, that's just brushed off. And in fact, the child is killed in a way that would be in a Friday the 13th movie. Like, let's mount somebody's head on a spike. And, like, why is that in this movie? Like, that...
So Radio Silence is notorious for being very bloody, but they didn't go this far. Honestly, my impression is that that's the influence of the Terrifier on this film. Like, that's the only way that I can explain it, because the Terrifier is so popular. It is known for its over the top gore. And this film went really over the top with the gore and the kills. And maybe they're thinking, look, we lost, you know, Jenna Ortega, we lost everything else. We got to give him something. And we don't have a great script, so let's give him great kills. And that's the only thing I can kind of answer, because I don't know why it was this aggressively mean and mean-spirited. Because oftentimes the killers, like, they kill, but they're not, like, mean-spirited. This was really mean-spirited, and I didn't love that.
I did like, you know, now that I've said that there's no second generation, they've introduced already now the daughter of the Nev Campbell character.
Mm-hmm. Tatum, yeah.
Yes, what's the actress's name? Anyway, I thought she was good.
She's good. She was in 1883, I think the name of the show is.
Oh, right.
She's good.
Yeah, so unless she just blows up and becomes
Isabel
too
May.
Good for these... Yeah, unless she becomes too good for these movies like Jenna Ortega does. But I don't think that's going to happen. So maybe she can ride out several more of them.
I'm going to be honest with you, looking at her and looking at the acting, she's not going to get too big. I wasn't that impressed. I'm going to be honest with you.
She passes the test like young Neve Campbell did of being, oh, she's such a sweetheart. And you really want to, you know, just watch this person.
But like Jenna Ortega or Mikey Madison, they blew up past the Scream franchise. Whoever this girl, Tatum, what's her name again? Sarah, you say her name was?
Isabel May.
She's not going to blow up beyond this. She has limits to her abilities. I'm sorry. She's not going to blow up past this.
I feel like if you like horror movies...
And if you like smart films. If you like smart movies. Well, yeah.
If you like this kind of movie at all, like, why would you not include this in your diet? Like, they're, as far as these things go, as much as I'm sort of shitting on the attempts at highbrow, like, as we know from the history, I appreciate any attempt because it's so rare tries to be thoughtful at all. And you know, this is such a better as a franchise than, I don't want to start naming things that Lawrence loves, but I know from that same podcast that you think Friday the 13th went terribly off the rails by, you know, number 5 or whatever.
Way off the rails.
This is not way that off bad the rails at all, like, compared to that. It is not a, somebody owns the rights to this and just wants to keep churning them out as fast as possible to get a little bit of money. And if they go straight to video, that's fine. It's not
that situation. I mean, even
to video. What decade is this, Mark?
Even Halloween goes off the rails. I mean, just because I love a film doesn't mean that I would argue it's a good film. I mean, those are two separate things. But this is a film franchise that has really stayed on the rails. Like, Halloween went off the rails. Friday the 13th, you know, Freddy, Nightmare on Elm Street. All those film, even, you know, Hellraiser, they all went off the rails. This one, if you know what you're going to get, it doesn't jump the shark, I would say watch it. And I would say it is a smart film. At least the first one. Now, they're horror films, but they're smart horror films, and there's something to be said for that.
All right. You're not a convert, Sarah.
No, I think I'm done. I think I've watched Scream now.
sounds good. Thanks for taking one for the team. No thanks to Al. Thanks to Lawrence. Thanks to the listeners. Bye.
Bye, guys.
Bye. Thank you.
Pretty Much Pop is part of the Partially Examined Life podcast network. Get more Pretty Much Pop at prettymuchpop.com. Get bonus content for every episode at patreon.com/prettymuchpop.